but I didn't think that it was going to be necessarily very easy. It's not necessarily, it wouldn't be inappropriate, but it was challenging to come up with a set of slides. Looking at some other verses here and there, but particularly we're going to stay in chapter 4, maybe a little bit in chapter 3 as well. And I wanted to say a thank you to the congregation for giving me an opportunity, and also to the men that went before me, particularly with Oliver and Steve and Jordan, as they've all delved into the first three chapters of 1 Peter. It's an interesting book, and it certainly has some of the verses that we will read today are some of the ones that I find most compelling, most inspirational, things that help you get through an average day, a day in the life of a Christian. These are the things that we read, are the things that we can use in our lives practically. Like, as soon as you walk out this building, these are the things that you're going to be using. So it's a good study that we have. And as a means of review, just really quickly, remember that this book was written to, Peter calls it the dispersion, but we can tell through context that this is the dispersion of Christians, particularly probably from Rome out into greater Europe and Asia Minor. And he wrote it approximately in 62 to 64, sometime around there. The way we know that is because Nero was the emperor, and Nero killed himself in 64. And Nero is thought to be the one that put Peter to death, so he had needed to write it sometime around then. So he's writing to Christians in a time where being a Christian was new, but it was also very difficult. It was very difficult to be a Christian. So with that context in mind, let's jump into, I want to start in, actually, verse 1 of chapter 4. The first word is therefore. So that therefore means we need to take a step back. We need to look back at what's the reason that he's moving on to this next thing. And although in verse 1 he covers it, we're going to go back to verse 18 of chapter 3. And again, personally speaking, this is one of my favorite verses in the entirety of the Bible, just because it puts into perspective our relationship with Christ. So in chapter 3 of verse 18, it says, "For Christ also suffered once for the sins, or for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit." And then skipping down to chapter 4 and verse 1, "Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God." This summer, my family and our larger family spent time down at the Florida College Oregon camp in Salem area in Oregon. And the theme of the camp was to be a servant. And one of the Bible class verses that we focused on for one of the days of camp there was in Philippians. And I want to quickly read that, and I don't want to dwell too much time. And to be honest, I've allotted certain times for sections of my talk, and I know that this is probably going to be the longest one, so we might not get past verse 2. I'm going to try my best. But in Philippians chapter 2, in verse 5, it says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross." So, have this mind that was in Christ, was in Philippians, and it talks about Christ's willingness to present himself, to humble himself first. And this is what we focused on in camp, as being a servant. The way that we become like Christ is we lower ourselves and we esteem others above ourselves. So we bring ourselves down and elevate people over us. But Christ was the ultimate example in that he brought himself down from the pinnacle of existence in heaven to the lowest form, the basest form of death as a man possible. And he did it not because he enjoyed it, not because he loved the sacrifice, it's because he loved us. And so that is true definition of service. And going now over to Peter, when Peter's talking to these Christians, he's saying, arm yourselves with this mind that Jesus had. And that word there, arm, and I always hesitate to put Greek words into my my classes because I'm going to butcher how you pronounce it. Hoplizo, I believe, is the word for arm. It's the same idea of picking up a sword. It's the same idea of getting preparing yourself for battle. But this is not a physical battle. It's interesting that Peter, instead of saying, well, he's about to talk about persecutions, and he's saying, instead of taking up arms in a way that's physical, take up arms in a way that's like Christ. And the way that Christ did it was having a mind of service. It was having a mind of elevating others above himself. So in verse 1, it says, Christ suffered for us in the flesh, and that's what we need to be prepared to do. So we need to understand that in order to be like Christ, there is an equation there. If you want to be like Christ, to be like Christ is to suffer like Christ. So we can start off in verse 1 and ask ourselves, verse 1 and 2, and ask ourselves, have we suffered for the name of Christ? And if we haven't, you can then take the next logical step is, why haven't I? Because what the Bible is saying here is, Christ suffered, we're going to suffer. His followers are going to suffer. And here, particularly, Peter talks about the reasons that they're going to suffer and the way that they respond to it. But we can ask ourselves that. And if we're not experiencing suffering, then, you know, persecution from the world, then maybe our lives are too similar to theirs. But again, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So we arm ourselves with a mind like Christ to be like Christ. And so the arming happens, again, not physically, but happens in our mind, in our hearts, our biblical hearts. So in Mark chapter 7, Jesus talks about what happens, what is created in the mind of man. And again, not to spend too much time there, don't turn there, but I'll just read. For what comes out of man, that defiles a man from within. From within, out of the heart of men, pursued evil thoughts, adulteries, fornication, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blaspheme, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man. So the place that we need to start our battle, and it's not a physical battle, it's a spiritual, a mental battle, is we need to arm ourselves with the mind like Christ so as to convert the way that we would think. In verse 2, it says, picking up at the end of verse 1, it says, he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. And I like this too, in that Peter takes the suffering and kind of flips it on its head. Instead of suffering and we'll see more of this, instead of suffering in a negative fashion, suffering has positive benefits. And suffering, in this sense, when Christ suffered, if we suffer like Christ, we no longer worry about the things of this world. We're not going to worry about, where's my next paycheck? How can I get my kids this next big thing that they want? How can I, you know, do I need to worry about, what about my job? What about all these? We have many cares in this world, but when we suffer for Christ, those cares, they go out the window. So when we suffer, we focus. Right, it really is a testing, a trial by fire. So there's benefit to suffering, and I know it's easy to say, and we all can say it, and you can all nod your head, and we'll all agree that suffering does help us, but when we're in it, it's very much different to have that perspective. So, and that's why Peter is saying, now arm yourselves now with this mind that was in Christ. They knew what Christ was like. They are coming from a heathen lifestyle, a non-Christian lifestyle, you know, how Peter will refer to it as being Gentile. They're coming from that, and now they're changing their lives completely, 180 degrees. And now he's saying, you know what Christ was like. You know what Christ did and his thought process, the reason that he did it. Put that self, or have that same mind in yourselves. In verse 3, moving on to verse 3, it says, for we have spent enough time in our past lifetime in doing the will of Gentiles, when we walked in lewdness, lust, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. So, again, he's couching it under saying, he didn't say you have. So he could have said the royal we. I mean, I don't believe it was the royal we. He can say, you have lived in this way. But he says, we, including himself, we lived in a way that was not profitable. It was not according to God's will. and we lived in these various forms of sin. And we can go over each one, but for the sake of time, we won't spend time on each. But they're the ways, what he calls of the Gentiles is the ways of the world. We would see this in exactly the same way today. For those of us that work in the professional sector, in amongst many worldly people, which I would say almost all of us that have jobs outside of the home do, we see this on a regular basis. We see people going to after work to go drink. They're going to parties. They invite you to parties. Many things that we can't participate in, but we see that the world participates in them, and they see that as a common way of life. So the interesting thing is that the way that it was in the first century is the same as it is today. We see this, that the world sees things from a different perspective, and they see these types of behaviors that have dramatic, drastic consequences as normal, average behaviors, behaviors that everyone can and should participate in. So going on to verse 4, in that regard, to these things they think that it is strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. First, I wanted to define dissipation because it's not a word that we use a lot. When I looked it up in Thayer's had it was similar to debauchery or decadence. Also can be looked at as squandering. So not only are they living in this debaucherous, this flood of dissipation, this excess of dissipation, they're doing things beyond and in a very immoral way. They're doing it as to run to it, right? So they're saying, Peter's saying, they find it confusing or they don't understand why you don't run with them. So again, this gives us the hint that to do these things, you do them without thinking. These Gentiles do these things in a manner where they're running to it, headlong into something, and they're going to excess. And they find it curious that you don't participate in these things with them. And again, this is something that we can live with on a daily basis. So in many ways, and for many of us, it is a modern day form of trial, of persecution that we can endure. Because we need to look different. If we find ourselves running with the world, we are not being the Christian that the example that Christ set for us. In verse 5, it says, they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So then this brings it all home, right? So our actions, whether you are Gentile or whether you're a child of God, whether you're in the body or outside of the body, all are prepared to be judged, and we're going to be judged according to the things that we do in the flesh. And I think it's interesting, too, to see that in verse 5, it says that he who is judging is ready to judge. So not only is there a judgment for all at the end, but there's a judgment that's ready for you whenever your time on earth is done. So whenever your life is over and that judgment is ready for you, it will be time. There will be no ability to go back and fix things. There'll be no second chances. You know, when we raise kids, it seems like we live as parents on second and third and fourth and forever on out chances for our kids. But that's certainly not the example that the Bible sets forth. We have the opportunity now to live a life, again, that is according to the pattern that Christ set for us. And when our time on earth is over, there is judgment ready at that moment. And we will be judged based on on the life we lived. In verse 6, it says, For this reason, the gospel was preached also to those who are dead, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh, but live according to God. So it can seem a little bit confusing, but this is not talking about, if you think about it logically, Peter is not talking about the gospel being preached to dead people. It's people that have died and were preached the gospel, were saved through the gospel, were judged according to the gospel, so that they can live in the Spirit. And the same will happen to us. As we leave this life, we will be judged according to the Spirit. And it will be a determination at that point on how we lived our lives. So we're looking at Peter's giving them the reasons that we don't want to live the life of the Gentile. And again, understanding that the context, the audience that he's speaking to is probably mostly Gentile. They're coming from a lifestyle, again, that they're having to turn their back on the ways that they formerly lived. So that imminent, immediate judgment is important to understand as you're living your life, especially in the face of persecution and trial. Verse 7 and 8. But the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers. And above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. So the quote there, the love will cover a multitude of sins, comes from Proverbs, and there's another quote from Proverbs later on. So the end of all things is at hand. That's a scary thing to think of. Does it mean that Judgment Day is imminent? Yes, in the sense that God's plan is fulfilled. God's plan for the salvation of man has come to fruition. There's no additional things that need to happen for salvation to be provided. So once the point that Jesus died on the cross and was raised, then becomes the closing to the end. So we've gone from when Jesus was resurrected, at some point in the future, we're heading towards the end of mankind, to that the redemption of man into heaven and the judgment of the sinful into hell. We're getting closer and closer to that time. Does anyone know what will happen? When it will happen? No. But again, understanding that we're heading towards it, that it's near, gives us that mind that we need to have to, in order to be like Christ, instead of thinking about things of the world and what is important right now in my fleshly desires, putting my spiritual desires and Christ first in my life is much easier when I think of in eternal perspective. And I think, again, for myself, I struggle with this, but it's something that when you sit down and you're faced with trial, if you're able to step back away from that temptation or that trial and think about it, what I like to think of with eternal perspective, and think about our longer term investment, it's easier to see things for what they are, to see the here and now for the temporary vapor that they are, the trial that we're enduring, even the heaviest of trials. And in this instance, these people that Peter's talking to, he's about to tell them, you're going to go through a fiery trial. It's going to be very difficult. Fiery in the sense that fire destroys as it purifies. So there's going to be a fiery trial coming. But you need to understand that God has a plan for you, and that God works to redeem us. God has a plan that has been fulfilled through Christ. And having that mind in Christ will help us understand that it's not a physical battle that we need to wage against these people that are persecuting us. The Roman Empire, in this instance, is going to be the one that's enforcing this horrible judgment on Christians. But Peter is not saying that you need to pick up arms to fight. Because remember, Jordan talked a little bit about the transformation that Peter went through last week. As you can see, when he denied Christ all the way till he's writing this and his death is imminent, what a difference in the nature between the two versions of Peter. Peter that took up a sword and cut off Malchus's ear is now telling people, you're not picking up a weapon to fight. You're putting on Christ's mind to fight, and you're going to endure the suffering that you're about to go through. Okay, so, before I go, I don't want to gloss over. I think it's very important, again, for us practically as we look at this. So the end of all things is nigh, but in verse 8, above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover a multitude of sins. We have to have not only love for each other, but it's a particular form of love. It's a fervent love. It's a love that, again, elevates above everything else, elevates above others. So we need to put that love on. Again, thinking about it with the idea that these people are about to go through a persecution, if they don't have that love, that persecution will destroy them. That group of Christians will not exist. They will, again, be scattered. It's the love that is able to help us cover those instances where something happens, somebody potentially sins against you or does sin against you, but you're able to look beyond it. You're able to grant grace to the person. You're able to go beyond that instance of what happened, and you're able to maintain that fellowship and that love for one another because you're extending it fervently. You're not just, I love you. It's, I'm willing to do whatever it takes in order to maintain this relationship with each other. So love will cover a multitude of sins. Again, I don't think it means that love is going to say sin is okay, but love is going to look beyond simple things in order to maintain that fellowship. Okay, in verse 9 and 10, be hospitable to one another without grumbling. As each one receives a gift, minister it to one another as a good stewards of the manifold grace of God. So I think being hospitable and God's grace go hand in hand. I like it, not only be hospitable, there's an addition. It's not only be hospitable, but be hospitable without grumbling. So we all know, and not going to ask you all to nod, but I think we all could nod and say, I've been hospitable and I've not liked it. Right? So we've all been that way. And here it's saying, be hospitable, but don't grumble. Be hospitable because, going back to the previous verse, you have this fervent love for one another, and it's extending past lip service, but into what you're doing. Inviting people into your house, providing for others, putting them above you. This goes all together. And again, couching it with the idea that God's grace has been extended to you, how could we be upset about it? If we look at everything we do with the idea that God has extended grace to us beyond, far beyond what we deserve, there's no measure that we could go to help or serve someone else that will extend beyond what God's grace has already done for us. So these ideas are the things that Peter is really trying to ram home. Again, I want to really reinforce, because in my mind, this is how my mind works, is that this persecution is coming. Without these things, this persecution will cause Christians to fall away, the persecution that comes. And I think that although we don't face, at this point in our lives, and in our country, we do not face the fear of the government coming in and destroying us, taking us away. And these people potentially, if not at this point, at points in the near future, do experience that. We do have persecution. And we have a form of persecution that seems to be elevating, in that the way that we look at life through the biblical lens is being frowned upon. And is potentially could be, in the not too distant future, become illegal. So it's these things that we need to have, this fervent love, this hospitality, and extending grace as God has extended it to us. And it's not just grace. I love the term manifold grace. So it's not just grace in one way, but God has given us grace in so many ways we can't even number them. And that's, again, what we should extend out to others. Okay. Verse 11, it says, if anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies, that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, in whom belong the glory and the dominion forever and ever. So, to sum it up, we need to be like Christ, and everything that we do should be glorifying to God and to Christ. So when we find ourselves doing things, and I think, again, going back to hospitality with grumbling, is that glorifying God? We'd say, oh yes, but I'm doing what's right, but God judges our heart, and he knows our heart. And so it's not glorifying to God. It's this, I find it similar to the person that prays in public to be heard of men. His prayer is answered by having men hear them. Being hospitable to others without a proper attitude is very similar. If we are hospitable to others because we want them to be happy, but inside we're angry, that's all, our reward is the hospitality we extend to others. That's it. That's the extent of it. God doesn't extend it out further. That manifold grace cuts off when our attitudes cut it off, not because God doesn't extend it. It's interesting, and I don't want to spend too much time, but that word oracles, it's seen like four other times in the New Testament. It certainly is very much, it falls along the idea, the Greek/Roman idea that the gods for the Greeks and Romans passed their knowledge to individuals who then imparted it to the world. And that's, we have the God of creation that has created all things through Christ extending his word to us now through the Bible. Through at that time they had the apostles and the prophets, and you know, speaking or the spiritual gifts. whatever we do, whether it's through a spiritual gift that they had at this time or as we have through the Bible right now, it should be through God's word. Where we speak should be where God speaks, and we remain silent where God's silent. We don't impart what we, our translation, our version of what we think God says. We say what God says, and we stay silent where God's silent. In verse 12, let's read 12 through the end of the chapter. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, and that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part he is blasphemed, but on your part he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief, an evildoer, or a busybody in other people's matters. If anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this manner. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God, and it begins with us first. What will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. So, first off, in verse 12, there's a fiery ordeal that's coming to them. For those of us that are interested in history, and perhaps you know just from hearing sermons about it, the Roman persecution of Christians, which happened at Nero's time and beyond, was very difficult. It was sickening. I am still teaching the teenage class on Wednesday nights, we talked about Bible geography, and when you talk about geography, you talk about history, and we talked about the expansion of the Roman Empire and the ultimate persecution, the degradation or the slandering of the name of Christian happening during the Roman Empire because of a sequence of events. And you can trace them back to Nero again and a fire that happened in Rome that he potentially had set and blamed it on the Christians, where this persecution really started. And there was physical, punitive punishment placed upon Christians just for being Christians. I mean, examples are, gladiators in the Roman arena, Christians being the people that are going to be slaughtered just for the sake of being Christian. Also, they are tarred and set on fire. I mean, horrible examples, and you don't really want to talk about them. But the reality is that this is what these people were facing moving forward. And that's the physical punishment. The societal, the cultural punishment had been happening well before that, right? When we go back to the beginning of 1 Peter, the fact that we were different than all of the other Gentiles, that these converts changed their lives, and Paul is a perfect example. He was a very zealous Jew, and when he changed, the Jews hated him. The Jews loved him and then hated him. The same happens with our friends and our family when they see that we won't run with them in the things that maybe we used to, or even if we didn't used to, we certainly don't do it with them, and they are forced to question, why am I doing it? People feel bad, and they don't like feeling bad. So then it becomes not their problem, but your problem. So that persecution happened well before the Roman persecution that started. So Christians are living a life where they're going to be under the microscope of everyone. And that's why we have the example that God has given us to live a life that is like Christ, that following the pattern that Christ set, so that when we suffer, Jesus is glorified. They're elevated. Christ is elevated. And that's why we endure the things that we endure. And one of the last things, almost out of time, I wanted to talk about something that caught my eye. If we go to verse 15, let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. Okay, so let's go. We're not going to go into the details of all of these, but I don't think many of us really have to worry about being a murderer. I can't read all of your hearts. I don't think many of us struggle with, I want to murder people. Being a thief, now that's a little bit different, but it's certainly, we wouldn't, most of us, not, I doubt any of us would consider ourselves a thief or an evildoer. But then we get into the busybody, and it's very different, right? So we went from very drastic, like taking someone's life, to being a busybody. Also, I think in the New King James Version, it says a troublesome meddler. It's an interesting way of putting it. But I went through, and I was going to read a passage from Thayer's, but I won't for the sake of time. But it's the idea that not only it's not doing something wrong, it's the getting involved in other people's business to the point that we are overstepping our bounds. So even if you're for the reason of doing things that are right, so if you are, say, wanting to get involved in politics, but you want to do it in a way where you're really forcing home your belief and you're really trying to push your agenda forward in a way that gets involved in everyone else's lives, that's not what you need to be involved in. In fact, that's what we need to stay away from. Peter says, let's none of us suffer for that reason. So we could suffer because we get involved, but let's none of us suffer for getting involved in these activities. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. So the judgment happens with the house of God first, and then Peter makes the example. If it happens to God's people, what are going to happen to the people that chose to not follow God? So there's two places. We have those that follow God, hear the message and follow God, those that hear the message and don't follow God. You don't see that there's a talk about the gray area people. There's no gray area people. There's those that follow and those that don't. And if those that follow are persecuted, what is the natural, logical assumption? What's going to happen to those that don't follow God? It's not a good situation. So then lastly, therefore let him who suffers according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. So that's why we do what we do. That's why we endure what we endure. Sometimes it's more difficult than others. But the reason that we do it is because we have a faithful creator and we're committing ourselves to him. And he has promised to provide us salvation. And with that, we'll close class.